Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, it's 200 years since his birth and 150 since the publication of On the Origin of Species. Yes, you've guessed it, it's a show all about Charles Darwin. All the studio guests are sporting full-length Darwin beards, including Alan Rutherford of Nature Podcast and Magazine, who'll be telling us about a debate to mark Charles Darwin's birthday in Oxford last week between Richard Dawkins and Bishop Richard Harries. We've also got the highlights of a debate held here at the Guardian HQ at King's Place. More Darwin than you could ever hope to shake a beard at. And we'll also talk to Sir David King, former chief scientist of the government, who gave this year's Darwin Day lecture. This is Darwin Weekly, sorry, Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to all our pod fans. Adam Rutherford is here from Nature Magazine and Podcast. Hello, Adam.
Hello, everyone.
Now, if you've ever needed proof that intelligent design was true, look at the fine beard on James Randerson's face. That can't have been natural selection, James. How'd you do it? How'd you design that thing?
Topiary.
Excellent. Last week was Charles Darwin's 200th birthday. He isn't actually alive, of course, but you get the point. To mark the occasion, there were parties up and down the country, some more serious than others. Going to one of the more serious ones in the moonlight from his proper job, Adam spent an evening in Oxford with Richard Dawkins and Richard Harries. Adam, obviously you're very excited about evolutionary biology, being one yourself, an evolutionary biologist. We all know who Richard Dawkins is. Who's Richard Harries?
Well, Richard Harries was the Bishop of Oxford. Now he's a Lord, although I understand that you actually retain your bishopry for the whole of your life. So him and Dawkins appear to be friends. I've seen them interviewed on his on Dawkins' Channel 4 programmes before, and they're pretty good buddies. Of course, Dawkins is a public atheist, and of course, Bishop Harries is a member of the Church of England, so they do disagree on some fundamental points.
Like the existence of God.
That's the main one.
So you went to see them in debate in Oxford. What was the context of it?
They were revisiting, as it said on the ticket, a famous debate that happened in 1860 between Thomas Henry Huxley, who was known as Darwin's bulldog, and Soapy Sam Wilberforce, who was the Bishop of Oxford at the time. Now, the original debate in 1860 was characterised as being pretty contentious and pretty irritable. So I bumped into Philip Pullman, the author, in the queue as we were going in, and I asked him if we thought we were going to see fisticuffs of the same order.
I don't think it'll be bashing out, and I very much doubt whether there'll be fisticuffs. The original event, which this is commemorating, the debate, famous debate between Thomas Henry Huxley and Samuel Wilberforce, the Bishop of Oxford, was notorious, I suppose, for its Wilberforce's own silliness about the whole issue. I look forward to a very even-tempered and friendly conversation this evening. Both men are extremely civilised.
Well, you and I have just had the privilege of listening to a wonderful performance of Haydn's Creation, which I think it was specially put on for your honour, Richard, because we knew that you want to begin this evening by listening to some words of Scripture and hearing how wonderful they were. Now, listening to that, that's not science. But it is saying, first of all, there is something awesome and wonderful about the universe, which I know you believe in very strongly. And I'd like to get on that at some point, because you've described yourself in public, on film, as in some sense a deeply religious man. And I'm sure that for you, as for me, in Haydn's Creation, something of that sense of awe and wonder before the universe was expressed.
My feeling was that even the wonderful music of Haydn couldn't disguise the banality of the words that we were listening to. We need great poetry to express the wonder of the universe, but Genesis isn't it. Or if it is, there's nothing special about it. You could go to the origin myths of any people, ask any anthropologist.
Well, I think I disagree with you on literary grounds there. Let there be light. And God saw everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. You can't do better than that.
I think we're just going to have to agree to differ on that.
Is there a problem for you as a bishop in telling your congregation, or what is it bishops have? Dioceses, don't they? I mean, telling your flock that part of the Bible is clearly not meant to be believed. And parts apparently are meant to be believed.
Which is which,
yeah. Yes.
Well, people believe things in different ways.
But it's not true. I mean, you've just said...
There are different kinds of truth. There are moral truths, there are spiritual truths. There's the truths of history, and there are the truths of science. The Bible is not about the truths of science. It does contain some historical truths, but it contains some religious truths written from the standpoint of Judaism and Christianity, that there is something very special about us human beings, that we are made in the image of God. That is the sense we can think and know that we're thinking, we can choose, we're conscious of moral choice, we can pray, that there is an ultimately wise rationality behind this universe who desires to enter into relationship with us. That's what the Bible is
about. Well, is the resurrection a myth as well?
I don't believe the resurrection is a myth. No, I believe...
Is the virgin birth a myth?
The virgin birth could be interpreted either way, and I'm not bothered too much about that. I mean, I do take historical fact very seriously, but clearly some proclamations of Christianity are more important than others. And the resurrection is absolutely fundamental.
But how do you decide? I mean, because it's all there in the Bible. You arbitrarily say, I'm going to believe that one, but not that one. That one's symbolic. That one I believe. That one's borderline.
Well, I'm not talking at the moment about whether it is true or not. I'm talking about whether it's important that it's true. That's the only point that I was making there. It is absolutely fundamental to Christianity that the resurrection of Christ, in some sense, some very real sense, is profoundly true. I believe that if that was not the case, then it would not be possible to be a Christian believer. So I do take very seriously the importance of certain alleged, in inverted commas, historical facts. When I put it in inverted commas, because clearly the resurrection is both within history and out of history, not totally containable within what we call historical criteria and parameters.
But you seem to be saying that...
We seem to be getting on to religion rather than science. I think we need to... I think we need to... Getting off creation.
No, but you're the one who articulated this argument that these two things were not incompatible.
Yeah.
We're just getting into some other areas where they might be incompatible. I've not come across any other resurrections. Go on, Richard.
When you say that, and of course I agree with you, that the universe is wonderful and great and awe-inspiring, I find that I get that from science, and the more I learn about science, the more wonderful it is. And then if I go and read something from not just the Bible, but really any piece of sacred text, any piece of anthropological speculation, I find that I'm brought down to earth with a bang. It suddenly ceases to be so grand, it becomes rather petty, rather small. It's, of course, interesting from a historical point of view that people have believed these things and every tribe in the world believed different things. There is a certain interest in it. But it doesn't even begin to measure up to the scale of the universe. That's what I meant when I said that even Haydn couldn't really redeem the words of the creation that we were listening to. It's small, it's petty, it's diminished. If only Haydn had lived a century or so later and could have written the Evolution Oratorio.
But wouldn't you say that all the things which you regard as small and petty, leaving aside whether that's a correct judgment, do clearly reflect our human limitations to grasp the majesty and wonder of the universe? Because I put it to you, if you feel like this about the universe, which you clearly do, if there was a fountain origin of the universe, then that fountain and origin must by definition be even more awesome and wonderful, however inadequate the limitations of our attempts to grasp and express that.
Yes, indeed, and that's one of the reasons why I don't believe it, but we could come on to that later. Well, when you say fount...
But all I'm asking you to say yay or nay to is that you clearly have this profound sense of wonder and awe before the beauty and the complexity of the universe. All I'm suggesting to you that if there was a wise rationality behind all this, which caused it all to come into being, which moment by moment holds it in existence, then by definition, that wise intelligence would be even more awesome and wonderful. If there was, that's all I'm saying. I'm not putting in the same corner of saying, you know, that. But if there was,
what I meant was that my reason for not believing in it is precisely that something that an intelligence capable of designing something so wonderful would exactly, in your words, have to be even more wonderful. That means even more improbable. Now, the biggest legacy I think that Darwin has given us, not just in biology, what Darwin has given us is a way of explaining how you can start from ultimate simplicity, the simple beginnings of the universe, the simple beginnings of life, and build up to it by slow, steady, intelligible steps to all the wonders that we see. That's what science does. Science explains how you can get these wonderful things if you start from something simple. Now, if you start from something complex, like an intelligence, then you've sold the pass. You have smuggled in a non-explanation disguised as an explanation.
But there is another kind of explanatory theory. When you go home or I go home and we wonder about the experience of beauty or love or the pain of life, and we wonder what the heck's it all about. Now, you're not going to get a scientific explanation to that. You're going to get an answer that either there is a purpose or there isn't a purpose or we don't know, but it's a totally different kind of... It's a totally different question requiring a totally different answer. And what goes into making up of that answer is not just what you discover in the laboratory. It's your experience of beauty, it's your experience of moral struggle, experience of human relationships, experience of love, of evil. All these go into trying to see whether there is answer. I'm not saying there is answer, but it's just... I'd like you to acknowledge that there is a different kind of question which requires a different kind of answer.
I will acknowledge that science is not, at least at present, capable of providing a fully satisfactory explanation for feelings of love and beauty, the overwhelming feeling from reading a Shakespeare sonnet or something like that. I will accept that. What I will not accept is that religion provides any better an explanation than science does of that. These are mysterious things at present. They're mysteries which I at least believe science in principle can solve. Maybe it won't ever in practice solve, but in principle, you do not add anything to your understanding of a love of beauty or happiness or just plain love by injecting a supernatural creator. That doesn't help. We've still got a mystery. We've still got a mystery that we're working on. And it's very difficult.
So you heard Richard Dawkins and Richard Harries there. Now, Adam, we intimated this earlier slightly. These two, they've argued together before. Bishop Harries is a very reasonable chap. He thinks that evolution, natural selection, is a great idea. He doesn't think that it's anything contentious with Christianity at all. What were these two ever going to really disagree upon, apart from the usual sky god business? What came out of this discussion?
Well, that's an interesting question. The original debate was mostly about the science. Wilberforce actually opposing the science of evolution. In this conversation between the two Richards, they both fully understand and accept evolution by natural selection to be true. So in that sense, most of the discussion was framed around what I think are unanswerable and actually not very interesting questions as to whether God exists or not. One of the interesting points that they got to is a question of metaphysics. They almost tried to deal with the subject of whether all things are knowable. And I think that Dawkins said that in principle, at least in principle, all things, such as difficult things like falling in love or spirituality, are essentially in principle knowable. It was a pleasant way to spend an evening. It wasn't fisticuffs. It wasn't like the original debate. It was two guys who agree about a lot of things, having a nice ding dong over a pint, whilst the middle classes of Oxford looked on.
Okay, well, to wind up then, who won?
I think Dawkins won on points.
So rather like the original then.
I think so. Yeah, I think that ultimately Dawkins had stronger arguments Harry's did a little bit of hand-waving and therefore lost it.
I think you're biased, though.
That is certainly true. I asked the chair of the debate was Jeremy Paxman, who tried to inject some controversy into the proceedings for about half of it, but then gave up because they were agreeing so much. I collared him after the debate and asked him who he thought had won.
Who won? Well, the funny thing was, it didn't really seem to be a contest in quite that sense. There wasn't really a great chasm. Invited the immediate question, well, in that case, what is the point of belief? And we didn't really get to that because it's an illegitimate question in Richard Dawkins' analysis. But I was, it was really high quality conversation. I thought they were really, really good.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's a Paxo there. More Darwin in just a moment.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. James and Adam, off you go with the news jam.
News jam.
The credibility of the official system of drugs classification in the UK suffered a fresh blow last week after the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, again vetoed a key recommendation from her own expert drug advisers, this time to downgrade the dance drug ecstasy from its Class A status. The government said it would not send a signal to young people that ecstasy was being taken less seriously. David Nutt, the chairman of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, said its role was not to send messages to the public, but to provide the Home Secretary and Prime Minister with evidence of the relative harm posed by different drugs.
One of the largest penguin colonies in the world is under threat because the birds are being forced to swim further to find food. Magellanic penguins living in the Punto Tombo colony on the coast of Argentina are feeding 25 miles further from their nesting sites than they did only a decade ago. The extra distance spent searching for food during the breeding season takes its toll on the penguins and reduces their chances of having young.
Scientists have unravelled the genetic makeup of the Neanderthal, the long-faced, barrel-chested relative of modern humans. Anthropologists analysed more than a billion fragments of ancient DNA plucked from three Croatian fossils to construct a first draft of the Neanderthal genome. This extraordinary feat gives researchers an unprecedented opportunity to clarify the evolutionary relationship between humans and Neanderthals that may ultimately shed light on the great mystery of how we became the most formidable species on the planet.
Encouraging toddlers to use hand gestures can improve their vocabulary and boost their chances of doing well at school a few years later. Pointing and other hand signals seem to give babies a head start in learning language skills, possibly by helping them to make connections between words and the objects in the world around them. The work highlights how interacting with toddlers can have a marked impact on their brain development, even before they've started talking.
James, Adam, thank you very much. Let's go into those a little bit. James, do you want to bring back Andrew Randerson for the drugs issue? We've talked about this many times. David Nutt is a friend of this podcast. We like him a lot. Jackie Smith, I'm beginning to dislike more and more. Give us a bit of background on this.
He came on the podcast and ate some cake, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, that's right. It was our first anniversary podcast some time ago.
Well, so yes, David Nutt, obviously the chair of the ACMD, which is the government's advisory council, they've come up with this advice on ecstasy saying that it's not as dangerous as other Class A drugs like heroin, cocaine, crack, that sort of thing.
Or horse riding.
Well, and I'll come to that. The point here is that the drugs classification is supposed to reflect the relative harms posed by different drugs. The advice that they've come up with is perhaps not a huge surprise, given that David Nutt, what was it, about 18 months ago, wrote a paper that ranked different drugs in order of their relative harm based on a selection of things: harm to society, harm to the individual, how addictive they are, things like that. And ecstasy was way down the list. So he's also written another paper which was trying to quantify that risk, and in a slightly ill-advised, light-hearted way, arguably, he compared it to the risks of horse riding. And purely statistically, horse riding is more dangerous because, you know, depending on the number of people who do it, you have more deaths from horse riding. And so this particular kind of statement was brought up last week again in the press, and you know, Jackie Smith came down on him like a ton of bricks, really.
Well, let's be clear, that statement was made in a paper published in the Journal of Pharmacology, a peer-reviewed academic journal, in which he said, he compared the deaths from horse riding in a year to, I think it was deaths from ecstasy, or maybe it wasn't even in a year, it was over a certain period of time. Anyway, the numbers were horse riding in equivalent time. Horse riding, 150 deaths, ecstasy, something like 30. 30 deaths too many. But he said, if you're comparing harm of different things, horse riding seems to be more harmful. There was a comment made in an academic journal, which then that was several months ago. And then I think the Sunday newspapers picked up on it and put it on the front page. And then obviously, because this government reacts only to Sunday newspapers, Jackie Smith thought, right, I must say something about this, and wanted him to apologise to not only her, to the country.
She rang him up, you know, on his mobile demand an apology.
It said an apology to all relatives who died from ecstasy. And then he said in Parliament that he should do the same thing. Now, he did actually apologise in the end. He said, if I've caused offence, then I'm sorry.
I mean, we should be clear that ecstasy is not a safe drug. No drugs are safe. And it's a tragedy when people die through taking ecstasy. And, you know, I don't think in any way he was trying to make light of that. But to be fair to him, you know, he didn't make that statement contemporaneously in the kind of atmosphere that is obviously surrounding the fact that they're making a decision about this. You know, he made this as a statistical comparison in a paper several months ago, before, I think, he took on the job as chair of the ACMD. So, you know, obviously there's a kind of political aspect to this. I mean, a massive political aspect to this. And in his current position, anything he says about these things is sort of blown out of all proportion. I mean, none of the papers would have been interested in this paper, obviously, if he wasn't in the position he is. So I've got some sympathy for the guy, really. The message seems to be that if you move ecstasy down from A to B, then you're sending a message to the kids that it's okay to take ecstasy. It's not dangerous anymore.
We found that it's not as dangerous. So, you know, go ahead.
So it's okay. The evidence that that is the case is actually pretty flimsy, because we do have one data point here, which is, well, obviously cannabis was moved from B to C and has now been moved back to B. But when it was moved from B to C, the long, slow decline in cannabis use that has been going on just continued. There wasn't a sudden jump in the amount of cannabis use. So even that argument looks pretty flimsy.
Well, just one more point on this issue, which is that Colin Blakemore, former chief executive of the MRC, he wrote that paper with David Nutt on the new drugs classification system. I think it was in the British Medical Journal.
It was BMJ, I think.
And they proposed a new way to do this, where they got together police, psychologists, everyone, social workers, to look at the relative harm in different areas of different drugs. They came up with the interesting, not surprising statistic that alcohol and tobacco are much worse than a lot of these other illegal drugs. Colin Blakemore's point is simply this, which is that by classifying drugs in the way we do it now, illegal drugs, we're sending the kids, if you want, completely confused messages. So ecstasy, which doesn't seem to have as much harm as something like smoking. Ecstasy is a much worse drug than smoking, because smoking is legal, but they can see all around them that that's actually not having as much harm at all. And so, you know, what they just don't take it very seriously. And if you want the drugs classification system to have any serious advice-giving potential, then you simply can't do it in the way it's done now. All right, we'll leave that there. We'll go on to something a bit more positive. Neanderthals, James and Adam, you're both genetics fans. Why is the Neanderthal genome going to be helpful for us, Adam?
To my mind, this is the absolute pinnacle of science, the proof of principle that they're doing here, which is that you can take a species which is extinct and sequence its entire genome. I just think is completely awesome, not just because it's about human evolution, which is my sort of pet favourite subject, and genetics, which is my academic background, but they've done something truly amazing. I think these are the types of scientific endeavours which will inspire children to go into sciences.
So what are we going to learn from it?
Well, I mean, obviously the big question that always comes up with this is, to what extent did your ancestors date the Neanderthals.
Date the Neanderthals. I think dating might be too much of it. The bashing their head and shagging them is what you're talking about.
I was trying to be euphemistic. As we're recording this, it's nearly Valentine's Day. You know, I didn't want to get too graphic. But anyway, yes, did our ancestors shag the Neanderthals? And, you know, you can look at that sort of question by looking at the genetic diversity and trying to work out, you know, to what extent is there contributions from the human genome. It's quite a difficult question to answer for various reasons. So an interesting one.
Well, here's an interesting question that people always focus on when talking about Neanderthals. In fact, I remember this being one of my exam questions as an undergraduate. Did Neanderthals speak, right? Now, it talks to a broader issue, which is what makes us human. One of the things we do genetically now by looking at genomes is to look at genes like FOXP2, which confer unique human abilities. And so what we can do now is look at FOXP2 in Neanderthals, I mean, they have already done it, and say, did Neanderthals speak? And the answer is, well, they probably were capable of speech. That doesn't say did. It doesn't answer the question of did they. But it's those types of questions which I think are really interesting. It tells you how human were Neanderthals.
For everything you want to know about all these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science. This year's Darwin Day lecture was given by Sir David King. Formerly chief scientific advisor to Tony Blair's government, he raised the profile of the need for governments to act on climate change and most famously said that climate change is the most severe problem we're facing today, more serious even than the threat of terrorism. So here's what he had to say.
To celebrate the 200th birthday of this wonderful man, Darwin, we have come a very long way since then. And I'm just going to start by bringing up a quotation from Reverence. But this is an apology 200 years after his death. We misunderstood you, and we tried to practice the old virtues of faith, seeking understanding and hope that will make some amends. We do understand, they're saying, that because we originally opposed your views, there are still people opposing those views. Darwin was part of a wonderful scientific revolution, and when I say a part, of course, an enormous part. His theory of natural selection is still being developed as we speak now into more and more sophisticated forms. Molecular biology has taken it on to a different domain. Through the scientific understanding and the technology derived on it, and all of those advances, we have created a totally, totally different kind of society for ourselves. And I'm going to suggest that we can measure that improvement in terms of the improved life expectancy around the world. Yes, we've got to give tribute to the improvements in the structures by which we structure our society. But really, the improvements deriving from science, engineering, technology, agriculture, medicine, civil engineering, I'm going to pick out as a massive transforming capability in providing us with clean water conditions. Through those improvements, lifespan has increased from 40 to 45 at the beginning of the 20th century around the world to, in this country, we're now 80 and increasing year on year. There's no sign of that plateauing out. As a function of time, lifespan is still increasing linearly in all of our advanced countries. So measure success by life expectancy, and we have massive successes. If you're a very powerful country, you may tend to say, well, I need to protect my own people above all others. And therefore, if we're going to, for example, run out of minerals, there's estimated to be about 65 years of copper below the crust of the earth left for us to mine up, then shouldn't we send troops in to facilitate creating friendly governments wherever there might be copper? There's a very large Chinese presence in Zambia now, and I have little doubt that this is to do with that. Not troops. This is people building drainage systems, all very good, creating influence. British miners were in there long before the Chinese got there, for the same reason. I'm going to suggest that as we move through the century, unless we get to grips with this problem globally, we potentially are going to lead ourselves into a situation where large, powerful nations will secure the resources for their own people at the expense of others, and this can only lead to more conflict. And as we move through the century with rising sea levels and with increased crop production, land mass available to the growing population gets smaller per person. So land itself becomes a challenge. I'm going to suggest that future historians might look back on our particular recent past and see the Iraq War as the first of the conflicts of this kind, the first of the resource wars. The United States, having developed itself as a very oil-dependent economy based on its own oil production and then reaching peak oil in the United States and then worrying about energy security and supply and casting its eye around the world, and there was Iraq. Now, the estimate of the cost to America of the Iraq War is about $3 trillion. I'm quoting Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner's estimate. I went into the White House in 2001 to try and persuade them that decarbonizing their economy was the way forward. I didn't get much shrift at that time. But what I can tell you is that if I had managed to persuade the government of America that investing instead of going into Iraq, investing in decarbonizing their economy with roughly a tenth of that money, they would have managed it. So there are alternatives available to us, and the question is whether we understand what science and technology can deliver and get that understanding into the governance procedures of our governments. I happen to feel very strongly that there are these alternative paths in front of us where we do manage and govern through what science can deliver, or we go down the route of conflict, which is a more traditional route for managing these processes.
David King there. Adam, you've got a question for James?
Yeah, I mean, King's known for making headline-grabbing statements. Aren't all wars, to a certain extent, about getting resources?
Well, arguably, yes. I mean, you know, usually it's about land, isn't it, and about access to land. The significant thing about this was that he was saying Iraq was all about oil, and by implication it was nothing to do with getting rid of Saddam and weapons of mass destruction. And the fact that he was in the government at the time is significant, although it's pity perhaps he didn't express those views to Tony. But yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, when you really think about it, of course, all wars are about access to resources in some sense. But I think he's saying that those kind of flashpoints are going to become more and more intense because of water stress, less land because of climate change, less minerals out there in the ground because we've dug them up.
Now, James, you spoke to David King after the lecture. What did you speak to him about?
Well, you recall a few months back we had a story in The Guardian where we'd spoken to Ed Miliband, the minister at the Department of Energy and Climate Change, and he was talking about wanting a sort of grassroots movement on climate change akin to Make Poverty History, to try and give more of an impetus to politicians to do more about climate change because, you know, the problems are so difficult to deal with and they involve so much international cooperation and they involve so many kind of sacrifices potentially in the way people's lives are lived that they need more of an impetus from the bottom to do things. And I asked David King whether he thought, you know, it was about sort of leadership from above, from politicians or from below.
Clear leadership also needs clear policy making to be put in place. So it's fine for the Prime Minister to make a very good speech on climate change, but then you need all members of the Cabinet to look, because reducing carbon by 80% by 2050 will require every part of government to respond. I would like to see in every speech that Gordon Brown makes on the current fiscal crisis, that he also includes the current global warming crisis, i.e. decarbonizing the economy needs to be looked at alongside the fiscal crisis. It's as important as that.
Now, we're still getting very hot under the Charles Darwin beards here in the studio, but there's even more. Last week, our swanky new offices here in King's Cross in London hosted the first Nature magazine Darwin debate. This one tackled the question, are we still evolving? And those doing the tackling were psychologist and writer Dr. Susan Blackmore, Andrew Pomiakowski of University College London, and Henry G, also of Nature magazine.
If you had these implanted people with chips and what have you, and mobile phones in their heads and everything else, what's the unit of selection? The chips, the organisations of chips, the human body. Interesting. Probably multi-level selection going on.
You can't just abolish death, because death is a part of life. Working people retired and then dropped dead. They retired because they were too exhausted to carry on working up chimneys or in factories or down pits and were completely used up. And they died of, you know, miner's lung and just because they were worn out. Now we work in sedentary things. We live longer, but we die of other things. We die of cancer, we die of heart attacks, we die of strokes. So, you know, every time we think we go on a bit, we die, there'll be something else that will come and kill us off that will have to be addressed. My feeling is that the human lifespan is probably not appreciably extendable beyond its current range. If we were going to do that, if that were to happen, it wouldn't happen with a creature that looks anything like us or behaves anything like us, simply because of life history strategy. After you've reached your reproductive potential, that's it. You know, you may as well die as far as evolution is concerned.
As far as natural selection is concerned,
no,
not necessarily as far
as... looking after their children and things, that has implications.
Well, this is one reason why old age is there.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Granny...
Is useful. I want to be useful in the future.
Phew, you could almost hear the beards there, listeners.
Now, I think this was missing in the debate, but Andrew Pomiakowski, who's actually known as Pom by everyone, including his mum, he was one of my supervisors when I was at UCL many, many years ago, and we were working on a ridiculous creature called the stork-eyed fly. It had eyes on the ends of its stalks on its head, as the name suggests. Anyway, one time I was working in the cages and one of the experimental flies escaped, at which point he used a portmanteau of the two strongest swear words in the English language, which I cannot possibly repeat here, at me, which upset me as a young undergraduate. And then I caught the same fly, and he repeated it, but added the word genius at the end. So, Pom, very, very good man.
And look where Adam is now. More details on the rest of the Darwin debates from kingsplace.co.uk. Now, we did say that Ian Sample, who is in Chicago right now for the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science Conference, he was going to give us some stuff for this week, but being Ian, we don't know where he is exactly. We'll have more of that, though, next week, I'm sure. Don't forget to add your voice to the ever-lively debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. It remains for me now to thank our guests, James Randerson and Adam Rutherford. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. There'll be more Science Weekly a week from now. Thanks for listening.